Hello and welcome to another edition of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we're still fuming in association with AllFootballShirts.com. Well, it's like we've never been away, as the lucky 2,000 fans here at the Amex on Monday left bemoaning the injustices of VAR. Yes, we've had our rub of the green with Stockley Park, but the penalty awarded to Southampton on Monday has taken the injustices to a whole new level and makes the defeat pretty hard to take. But we have to dust ourselves down and get on with it as we face two games on the road in the coming week. First, we have a visit to Leicester on Sunday, and we are at Craven Cottage to face Fulham on Tuesday. With our home form becoming a bit of a concern, let's hope we continue to pick up points on the road. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wes, and we're delighted to be welcomed. Joined by another raw virgin in the shape of Brighton Home independent sports reporter Darren Howard. Welcome to the show, Darren. A raw virgin, we love those here.
We do.
At Reverb Towers. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your Albion history?
Yeah, thanks. No, thanks. Thanks for having me on, and good to see you both. So, well, as you said, I'm Darren. I work for the Brighton and Hove Independent, and we cover all things Albion across for the Brighton Hove Independent and Sussex newspapers. So, yeah, it's certainly been an interesting season to get going, and an interesting time all round, really, with everything that's happened since the first lockdown, how Brighton managed to keep in the Premier League, and now started the season playing some good football, but just not quite getting over the line in a lot of the matches, which was, you know, highlighted on against Southampton, especially in the second half. I think their performance summed up their season in the second half, I think.
How long have you been doing that particular gig then, Darren?
So I've been we're working for JPI Media, who own the Brighton Hove Independent, for about 12 or 13 years now. And been covering Albion predominantly for the last three seasons.
Got you. So, yeah. So is Brighton your team, though?
I'm an Ipswich fan. So.
What?
You didn't do your research there, AD, did you?
Well, that's all right.
That's your perspective.
More welcome. Because I first,
I'd rather talk about Brighton than Ipswich.
Oh, fair enough.
Well, because I first met you because you took over from a friend of the show, Steve Bailey.
Yes.
And I think one of your first games was away at Man United at Old Trafford. I think that's where I first met you then.
That's right.
And it's, you know, it's coming on leaps and bounds. I mean, that we've had lots of changes in style since then. I mean, what have you made of the transition under Graham Potter?
I like it. I think it's a good style of playing football, and I think most it's always going to divide opinion, but I think the style that he tries to bring to the team is a positive. It's not always going to work every week, particularly with as he tries to introduce some of the younger players into the team. They're going to make mistakes, and there are going to be some tough times, and it is the hardest league in the world to play in, and to blood youngsters as well. Mm. I think overall, I think it's been positive. It hasn't been perfect. I think everybody would admit that, but I think I like his style of football. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move along to.
Well, hang on a minute. Hang on. We've got an important question to ask an Ipswich fan here, AD.
Oh. No, we didn't do banners, is it?
It's, yeah. Go, let's go back nearly 10 years. Does that banner anything to do with you?
Which banner?
Okay, right. I'm going to enjoy this bit then. Right. And I'm going to see. I'll tell you what. Well done, anyone who can remember the exact wording, because I think it was about a triple negative here. So it's the first season at the Amex, and Ipswich Town are in town. And it's a lovely sunny day, and we're looking forward to the game and, you know, welcoming Ipswich fans. And there's this whole new culture going on of drinking beer before the game and drinking beer after the game and welcoming people in and, you know, not having to sort of, you know, face three rows of coppers. Everyone's sort of mingling and what have you. Anyway, they're doing the warm-up, and just as the players are coming out, this banner appears in the away end. the Ipswich end in the South Stand. There are things money can't buy. Football isn't one of them. Was that it, AD?
Something along that. Basically, they were having a pop about us and
us being in the
dynamics.
Corporate world now.
And,
yeah.
Does this ring
bells with you, Darren?
Well, this is the first I've heard of it. To be honest, I grew up in the days where we were sponsored as a Pioneer. I think we had Bisons as well. So I think it goes with the territory with football clubs. You get sponsored by all sorts of companies.
The point was, I think it was a play on MasterCard, and yet we're sponsored by American Express. So that's where it falls down. And as someone, and I don't know if this is if you're from that neck of the woods, but someone at the East Anglia Press did point out that of all people who are actually, you know, going to sort of reject corporatism, it's going to be Brighton fans. So, you know, it was a kind of obviously we're picking on you as you know, well, you must have been in the crowd that day because
he supports Norwich. What?
No, because I've got a lot of time for Ipswich Town. I think, you know, we've always had a good time. Well, we've always lost there, but we've always had a good time there. And it's one of those clubs where you think, you know, if you're going to list a whole load of clubs, you think, oh, hate that place, hate those fans. Ipswich, I never have a problem with. And you just think that, and we were talking to Ipswich fans after the game, and they hadn't seen the banner themselves, so they don't know what the booing was about. And they were mortally embarrassed.
Yeah. One of my favourite things, which I wheel out on a regular basis, where people talk to us about the rivalry with Crystal Palace and not understanding it. I do like to point out the fact that Norwich and Ipswich are a mile further apart than Brighton and Croydon. So it's...
But I think that the Ipswich and Norwich one does make a lot of sense. You know,
true?
I mean, apart from, you know, the Essex teams, they're the main teams in East Anglia. So it makes sense. It's just that East Anglia is big enough that, you know, they happen to be 50 miles apart. It's just the Palace one, because Palace could have rivalries with everyone. You know, and we should actually, all we should be doing is picking up a rival with Worthing if we're lucky.
Or Crawley,
which probably even then, Worthing was still the bigger club. Yeah, quite.
Probably still is, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's move it swiftly on to Monday night.
We've got East Wilfborough, which is my hometown.
Oh, you're right. Okay. I mean, we could have actually done our research and actually found out. So in that case, no, I mean, I appreciate you want to move on here, AD. Right, you're from Eastbourne, you sport Ipswich. Darren, please explain.
Well, it was... I came here to... came down to Eastbourne for university. I did a journalism degree at the University of Brighton. But my family are from Norfolk. So, on the Norfolk-Suffolk border, so where we grew up, it was a little bit of content, you know, do you go for Ipswich or do you go for Norwich? My granddad was an Ipswich fan. My dad was as well, so I just sort of followed.
Fair enough.
And his favourite player is Frans Tyson.
The two Dutch guys. Yeah, back in the day, Arnold Muren, Frans Tyson.
Yeah, it was a good side, that UEFA Cup team. I mean, you know, John Walt, Mick Wills, Paul Cooper, Kevin Beattie, was it?
I think you had it from something like 73 to 82, which is when Bobby Robson left. Ipswich finished in either second, third or fourth, because they never won the title, but they finished second, third or fourth every year except one, which was 1978, and they won the FA Cup anyway.
That was the FA Cup year. And I think 81, maybe, was the UEFA. I think we won
the UEFA Cup. But you still do well in the league. I think you finished second in the league behind Aston Villa that year.
But the UEFA Cup, which is still probably the best-looking trophy in world football.
It was huge, isn't it?
But anyway, on to Monday night. I know we're trying to avoid it. We've got to do it. But, I mean, let's talk about the positives first, Al. 2,000 Albion supporters back in the stadium, and they made a racket.
We did. You know, when the players came out, it was before that, and obviously before the TV would have picked it up, but when the players came out, it was fantastic to hear them, although the first name that got chanted was Bruno's. But, you know, I was up in the West Stand Upper. I wasn't as cold as I feared it might be. You know, I could actually feel my toes still at the end of that, at the end of my feet. But, yeah, when they came out, I was genuinely choked up. I'm thinking, you know, there are 2,000 people who know that they're lucky, who know, you know, they've wanted to be back here for some time. And, you know, we've got some of our friends who have been in group four for the ticket draw, and they've got a ticket and they know what it means to be there. You know, they are so keen to be back there. It genuinely brought a lump to my throat. And I hope the players, you know, did appreciate that. So when they came out and did their warm up, you know, it was absolutely brilliant. And like I say, 2,000 people, there is a racket of sorts to be heard. Because when there's a chant that goes up, especially just across the north stand singing it, it's about 2,000 people singing it. Now, that's not to say that the whole place was singing when they could, but, you know, this was always going to be. Those who want to be at the front of the queue are going to be those who are going to make the most noise. I think it's just what goes with the territory of this. So, yeah, it was really, really good at the top of the west stand, upper to here, you know, the east stand, lower, and that part of the north stand singing along to whatever it was they were going to sing along to.
Darren, I mean, do you think it was slightly strange for the players, having played so long without fans, to actually have them back again?
It could have been. And there's an argument that some players may have, you know, benefited from not having any fans there for a while. But I think if you'd ask most football players, they want to play in front of, you know, supporters, ideally a full house. But 2,000 is a good, you know, step in the right direction. And I think just going on from what Alan said, I think when the 2,000 that are there as well, I think because they're there, they will sing more than what they probably would. You know, if it is a full house, so the ones that go would, you know, would give it a bit extra. They'd be singing, you know, singing more because they're just pleased to be back. But it was just good. We did a picture gallery on our website, and just to get the atmosphere of, you know, having the fans back, there was, you know, like queuing outside of burger stores and just like, you know, just that those sort of traditional things which have been, you know, sadly missing.
Now, this is an interesting question for you. This is a point for you, Darren. Now, I made this point the other day when I was in the West Stand up, when I was at a previous game, and the posters for whatever was being advertised in March.
It was Blue and White Day,
March the 25th. I assume that in the East Stand and the North Stand, you know, it's little touches like that. I assume that they've all been updated now.
Nope, still there. same posters. It's. I mean, it's going to be a while. I mean, obviously,
I know.
But it's just one of those things. I mean, I think once we get back into full swing of things, once people are going back regularly, because they weren't able to sell alcohol on the concourses for this game. And you know, there's certain things, but I think Albion and the community will be keen to get new posters up to promote their new things that they've got going on there. But okay, well let's go get involved in the game then. I know we don't really want to talk about it too much, but we're going to. And there was the team news was Tarek Lamptey was back in. Veltman kept his place with White moving into midfield. Morpay dropped to the bench, which wasn't quite as attacking as it was against Liverpool, which was confusing to a certain degree because it's a game we want to win, Darren.
Yeah, it's it was great to see Lamptey back in the team, as you say, and perhaps he didn't. I thought he was solid against Southampton, but perhaps he didn't have quite the impact that we've seen him make in the attacking third against Southampton, and also with. Against Liverpool, they had the three up front, didn't they, with Morpay, Connolly and Welbeck, who started. Obviously, Morpay went off after his miss, but it was good to see the three up front together. And yeah, it just wasn't quite, although they created chances in the first half, I felt it didn't quite look as sharp as an attacking force as they did against Liverpool. I'm sure, but there's probably... with the injuries that Liverpool had in their defence, there's probably an argument to say that Southampton's defence might have been, you know, slightly stronger than Liverpool were that day.
I think also you have to be careful about typecasting any given player as being of that particular position. So, yeah, we started the game against Liverpool with three recognised strikers, but as we pointed out on last week's show, they all had a kind of rotating job, and it's when they have the ball versus when they don't have the ball, plus that transition period of not being in the possession to being in possession and vice versa. So, yeah, we had two recognised strikers on the pitch when we started against Southampton. And I think that Darren's absolutely right, that Southampton's defence was a lot stronger than Liverpool's. And Graham Potter, I think, called it absolutely right, the way he saw that Connolly was going to be a pain in the backside to the Liverpool defence in a way that not so easy for the Southampton defence. So it sounds, when you think, oh, he's going hell for leather, he's picking three strikers against Liverpool, it's because that was a not particularly good defence. And on other occasions, you know, we could have actually sort of, you know, stuck it away. I'm okay with that particular setup. Lamptey coming back, I think, was obviously going to be a given. And he had his opposite number on toast, because as with the Liverpool game against them at the end of last season, this bloke had about three or four goes at him before he finally got booked, and he was a walking red card. And I cannot for the life of me remember the name. All I remember is he was the Southampton number 12, but he was a walking red card and not surprisingly got subbed at half time. Yeah, Lamptey was having, he wasn't having this sort of like big bizarre, you know, sort of no one's ever heard of him, so he's going to have some fun type game. But when he was on the ball, you know, he was still a handful to play against.
Well, this was the first time, of course, that a lot of our supporters have seen him in league action. But I mean, I think first half he was his usual live wire self. But I think Southampton managed to close him down quite nicely in the second half, and he wasn't quite as effective.
Oh, I fully agree. I mean, Southampton only really came out of the shell after the penalty, after we scored our goal. Apart from that, you know, the first, what it was, 35 minutes, I thought they were there for the taking. And again, and I'm sure you've got it in your notes, you know, missed a good chance in the first few minutes, missed that chance, you know, possible here and what have you, you know, if.
Okay, this was, it was actually turned out to be a 1-2 of sorts with Welbeck finding March on the left-hand side, who galloped at full pelt, and he put the ball on the plate for Welbeck, who'd made it into the box and really should have scored, but he couldn't quite apply the finish.
You can see he's settled in Brighton if he's missing those chances now.
This is true. Darren, what did you make of that?
I thought he was very good in the first half, by the way, Danny Welbeck. I thought the way he linked the play, and he looked, I think he's getting sharper as well. He looks faster. And I think if he can stay fit as well, and in a couple of games' time, I think he will, he should be at his you know, full level. And I think he's going to be an excellent signing for Brighton. I really do. I think he's really encouraging. And to have him alongside the likes of a younger striker as Connolly, and Morpay's only, you know, he's not super experienced either. He's still fairly, you know, fairly young in Premier League terms. And I think Welbeck was just, to get him on a free signing, I think was excellent.
Yeah, and he's hungry, and he wants to prove himself. But I mean, if it was a difficult chance, I'll give him that. But I mean, these are the sorts of opportunities that we've really got to be taking, because it was an absolutely wonderful run from Solly as well, I've got to say.
Right, there's another point here that we've got now with the return of the crowd. Now, admittedly, it's only 2,000, and I think that there was this. And let's say we've discussed it so many times on the Raw. How is Solly March? You know, it's going to be his last season. He's really got to step up to the plate. It's about time. And let's face it, I think that we probably all agreed that Solly March at the moment is playing the best football of his career in this first third of a season. Darren, before I carry on, am I talking out my bottom or would you go along with that?
No, I would go along with that. And I was disappointed last season because I thought he started well last season. He had him in the left wing back role a couple of times at the start of last season. He never quite kicked on. He had a few niggling injuries. And I'm so pleased to see that he's starting to, it seems to be, been saying it for ages with Solly, to fulfill his potential. But he really seems to be, you know, having the season of his life. And he's got two goals this season as well. And it's the first time for Brighton that he's got two goals in a season in the Premier League. So,
And there's also murmurings of an England call-up, perhaps.
I can't see that because of the nature way that England play and the nature way that we play. I don't think he'd be a particularly good fit.
The last England squad, there was no left-sided players in there at all. There's a paucity of players in this country, and you know, and anyone who's actually proving themselves in this league to be decent at that level is in with an opportunity. And why
you've
not
got a decent left peg, son? Right, you're in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a history we've had with English players. We never really have too many great left-sided players.
Yeah, but what happens then? We get Stuart Pearce and Chris Waddle, and what do? They sky their penalties. So, you know, let's not get too excited. The point I was going to make about it, you know, in asking Darren his opinion as well, is that he is finally having the season and finally playing the football that we'd like him to play, or rather he's not, in as much as we always saw him as this attacking winger, and here he is at left wing back. I mean, there is this argument to say he's not a defender. Actually, his defensive skills are actually pretty good, and it's not that often you'll find him out of position, no more than any other given left back. And yet then when he is versatile enough that when we do go to a flat back four, one thing you won't find him at is a left back in a flat back four. He'll go over to the right wing, for example, against Newcastle, and he caused more havoc and mayhem then as well. So, but the other thing about him is he's not so much bulked up, but he's actually got a bit more nous and a bit more strength in there, and he's not afraid to go piling in. I mean, witness what he did against Villa, witness what he did against Southampton, a little bit clumsy, but he's not afraid to stick the boot in now. He's not afraid to actually try and get ahead of his man. Graham Potter has done something to him, which has basically must have come from either sticking his arm around him or sticking his boot up his backside and said, look, you're a professional footballer, you're 26, you're in the last chance saloon. And I, for one, I'm really pleased that actually, but certainly in this first quarter, third, whatever it is of the season, he's actually finally realising a potential that I think a lot of us knew he had.
Yeah. Funnily enough, very shortly, we probably will be talking about Solly March piling in. But we'll come to that bit shortly. Now, War Prowse, he forgot what sport he was playing for a little bit, and it was a penalty, wasn't it? I mean, what was his hand doing up there?
I was watching it because where I was with the press thing, I was up in the back of the back row of the West Stand upper, and you could just about see the screens. And to be honest, from the naked eye, I wasn't sure. I mean, you just heard the entire East Stand go handball, and the referee gave it a moment and gave a penalty. And you could then see his reaction close up. It's like he said, we're going to take every puppy that you've ever known and shoot it between the eyes. He was that crestfallen. And then you see the replay. And again, all the things we have with VAR and everything gets checked. There was one check. That was it. Handball, son, shut your noise, it's a penalty. What he's complaining about, I have absolutely no idea. Darren, maybe you could fill us in on this.
Well, I think there's been some very debatable penalty decisions this season, and VAR has, you know, rightly come in for a lot of criticism, but there was no debate about that one. I think that's about as clear-cut as it can get. Right, we've had the controversy this season with some decisions, but I think that was, you didn't need VAR, you didn't need,
you know, I think the players were trying it on.
That was fairly clear cut. But it's good to see Pascal Gross tuck it away as well. So, and he's now on penalties now, Pascal Gross. So even if Morpay and Gross start, Potter said today that Pascal will be the penalty taker.
Oh, he's confirmed that.
If they're both on the pitch at the same time, then as it stands at the moment, Pascal is the penalty taker.
Oh, thanks for that heads up, mate. That's a good one.
It's been a strange couple of years for Pascal, really. I mean, he's been very much in and out of the side, but he seems to have cemented that place back in there again, hasn't he?
Going to say, I thought he could be on the fringes this season, especially with Adam Lallana. I thought they play in similar positions, but no, he enjoys playing with Lallana when Lallana's been injured as well. Gross seems to be the guy who, you know, links that or tries to link the midfield and attack to get them going. So I think, he's been a surprise this season, I think.
I've got to talk about this. Talking of midfield players, I mean, Pascal Gross is actually clearly offering something. He is one of those who will just sort of stand in the middle of midfield and spray the ball around. Because like you say, he doesn't offer pace. He doesn't offer movement. And so this is why he stuck Ben White into center of the into midfield. But this is alongside Yves Bissouma. Now, you last week, AD, were waxing lyrical about Danny Welbeck and how good he is and how good he could be. And I don't disagree with you. He is an excellent... He's the excellent striker we're looking for. And reading Andy Naylor's piece in The Athletic about his previous injuries, he was unlucky rather than more he's a sick note. So even then, we've got to take that into account, that there's a good chance that we could actually have a fully functioning striker for the rest of the season. Touch all pieces of wood known to man. But for me, the one who's actually coming on leaps and bounds, because he's had to, is Yves Bissouma. Now, I have yet to see... His role at the moment is that pretty much of what we saw Liam Bridcut do, of playing that central midfield role, but in a defensive form. Now, I know a lot of people want to see him go on a rampaging run. They want to see him get forward a bit more. But what I see from Yves Bissouma is one who can break up an attack when you realise that actually he was 10 yards away from breaking up an attack. He is less clumsy with his tackles. I mean, admittedly, you know, that someone might actually still get a kick in the face, but as much as you're raving, and this is going to be the touch of death, sorry about this, but as much as you were raving last week about Danny Welbeck, AD, as a striker, I've got to rave as much about Yves Bissouma. The bloke's still young, but he's tenacious, he's hungry, he's snappy, he's there, and, you know, he'll go in and win the ball, and his outball is almost always superb. That said, when he plays against Leicester, he's going to have a stinker. But for me, at the moment, so far, if the season was to end now, he'd be my player of the season.
I completely agree, Al, and I've really enjoyed watching him this season. In fact, actually, from the start of lockdown last season, he's actually come into his own, and he's been absolutely wonderful to watch. And Darren, I'm going to bring you in on this bit as well. My one concern about him is perhaps there is a disciplinary tightrope. He walks somewhere along the line, because I do see that there is a possibility there could be an accident waiting to happen sometimes.
Yeah, well, he's certainly a competitive midfielder, but my feeling is I don't think he goes over the top. I don't think he flies into tackles. I think he's quite disciplined. I think that's something he has learned, particularly this season. I know he had that incident at Newcastle, which was a nasty one for... was it Jamal Lewis? He caught him flushing the face, obviously. But I think he really adds a presence and an extra energy to the Brighton midfield. And with previously with Davy Proper and Dale Stevens, they were very solid, reliable Premier League midfielders. But I just think that Yves Bissouma just gives them that little bit of extra dynamism, and he's... And as Alan was saying, his outball is very good as well. He can get the play going forward.
What do you make of playing Ben White in midfield? I mean, particularly when we've got Stephen Alzatti chomping at the bit, waiting to get back into the team, and actually Davy Proper is going to be fit for this weekend as well.
Yeah, it's a bizarre one with Stephen Alzatti. I thought many of us thought that this would be his season, but I think Potter feels that I personally like to see Ben White in defence. I think that's his best position. I'd like to see him with alongside Lewis Duck and Adam Webster / Dan Byrne. But I think Ben White adds a bit of stability to the midfield. He's he holds it well with Bissouma and adds a presence. But my personal opinion is I think he's a better defender than he is a central midfielder.
I think when Lallana is fit, then Ben White will drop back into defence, and it's then Veltman who gets dropped back onto the bench. So I take your point. It's a case of Alzatti versus Ben White. And I was just wondering if you were actually asking that question along the lines of what Leeds fans are thinking, saying, oh, Brighton are trying to ruin him by playing him in midfield. For which, if I may answer on your behalf, saying I don't give a stuff what they think, but sorry, carry on.
He actually played in midfield for them last season a few times as well, so they can't
really say that.
Let's talk about the defence then. And there is still major question marks over them. Yet again, we conceded from another set piece. It was a wonderful ball in from Ward-Prowse, and it was a towering header. But this zonal marking experiment is not working for me.
I don't think any defence really, whether man-to-man or zonal, would have been able to do a great deal about that. Because even if it was man-to-man, Vestergaard, he lost Lewis Dunk. Lewis Dunk was pretty much man-to-man on him. See, it's not totally zonal. There are elements of the big ones are man-to-man. The rest of it is zonal. Now, the point is that Vestergaard did brilliantly to slip Lewis Dunk. And even then, and you have to give credit for it, that header was a big, booming, enormous header. One of those ones that it flew into, it wasn't at the top corner, but it was two thirds of the way up. If we're going to get on to criticising Matt Ryan, then I think he takes no blame, because a goalkeeper who is 6 inches taller would have only saved that if they started off in the wrong position. That was actually such a good header. It's the sort of thing that we used to get from Ulloa. We used to get from Murray. In this instance, this is nothing like as horrific as the goal we conceded against Aston Villa.
Yeah, it's been a bit of an Achilles heel for them this season. The set piece, the conceding goals from set piece. I think that there has been issues with the zonal marking, and it's an area which they're going to have to look at, because teams are clearly targeting Brighton because of this now. And when you've got someone like James Ward-Prowse who can, you know, he fizzes it in with such pace and accuracy, and if you've got some guys 6'6" coming up from the back, it spells trouble for Brighton. I don't know. It's something they're going to have to look at, because it's going to be, you know, it's costing them games. It's costing them points at the moment.
I mean, it was particularly frustrating because, it was such a simple goal. We've been getting a lot of corners and we've done absolutely nothing with them. And, you know, last season we scored a few goals from them. I mean, Webster was getting on the end of things. Dunk was getting on the end of things. But this season...
Well, isn't this the first one we've conceded from a corner this season?
No, because Everson scored as well, I think.
Did they?
Yeah, Jerry Mina scores.
I think 11 out of the 18 goals they've conceded this season...
set pieces.
If you include penalties. Yeah, they're set pieces, yeah.
Okay, that's
adding penalties into the...
That was a nice segue there, because we need to talk about it. When's a penalty not a penalty, Al?
Well, it's when it's not a penalty. It's when you're playing Southampton. So somewhere near roughly the, you know, just in the rough vicinity of the penalty area will do. You know, for those who remember the game about 6-7 years ago down at St Mary's, you know, it was near the corner, so a penalty will do. Spurs game early this season. Harry Kane tries to end Lallana's playing career, but outside the area. My first thought when I saw it with a naked eye was it wasn't a penalty. It was outside. Listen, first things first, AD, even with your blue and white tinted eyes, specs, headphones, underpants, could you acknowledge that it was a foul?
It was a foul. And this is where we... Because Solly Marks...
It was a foul, wasn't it?
...plowing in. And it was a foul.
Because you'd have normally argued that this wasn't a foul. It was never a foul in the...
No, this was... There's clearly a foul. No complaint about
the... Right, okay.
About that whatsoever. So, the complaint is that the ref got the decision right. The ref on the pitch, he called it exactly right. He got his little magic spray out. He drew his little line exactly where the free kick... And he was right. And there was not a clear and obvious error here. None. No...
Right.
Can I interrupt you here,
AD?
The ref got it right.
can I interrupt you here?
You might have to, because I'm about to explode.
Yes. Right. Okay. Well, in this instance, clear and obvious is not an issue, because, and as much as I was screaming about it earlier this week, I did actually make a point of looking it up. When the referee, well, VAR is also automatically going to look at something like this. When it's for a decision, like, for instance, the Solly March one on Trezeguet, then VAR will look for a clear and obvious error. In other words, it's the stuff that's subjective. It's the stuff that's open to interpretation. But with this, and then there's two parts, it's either offside or was it not in the area, or sorry, was it or in the area or outside the area? There is no subjectivity. It is a fact. So this is the reason why the referee didn't go back to the screen. It's not about clear and obvious. It's about was it outside or was it inside? Now, the issue then becomes, why did it take 2 minutes to decide, especially when you can't necessarily decide it? We then see the still of when the first contact was, and you see it's clearly outside. So it's not about the clear and obvious thing. It's just about the fact that the VAR referee called it wrong. And when we're talking about offsides and when we're talking about was it in the area or not in the area, clear and obvious goes out the window. It's not part of the decision making. It's was it factually in the area? Was it factually offside? And this is where the VAR referee got it hopelessly wrong. In that respect, I attach, as you say, AD, I attach no blame to the referee, because once he's asked, was it in the area, was it not in the area, the decision is taken away from him, like it would be with an offside decision. VAR referee got it wrong.
Darren Harris, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think, it was clearly... the initial contact was clearly outside of the area. And then the question was there a second foul once they'd come together and ended up in a heap where they ended up inside the box? And I think that's what the VAR believed, that there was a secondary foul and therefore gave the penalty on there, which was, the reaction from the players. It just seems to be a bit over micromanaging the game these days. The players were happy with the free kick. There was no reaction from the Southampton players. They seemed to think it was outside of the box. Everyone would have been happy to have gone on. Whether James Ward-Prowse would have scored from the free kick anyway, we don't know.
This is my point. I mean, a free kick outside the box for Southampton is like a penalty anyway.
Not from there. It was right on the corner of the box.
Have you seen Ward-Prowse this season now?
That's pushing it even for him. But
It is taking enjoyment out of the game, that's for sure. It was supposed to come in to correct the errors, but at the end of the day, you've still got a human who's making these calls in the VAR box, and you're still going to get errors, unfortunately.
But my point about this, Darren, is that, and you're quite right, what he was looking at was there a secondary foul. And the law does state that if the first one you could claim was you're offering up an advantage, and by the time the second foul takes place, then you're in the area. Now, the point is, having looked at it, the second contact between Solly March and the fellow he fouled, March got the ball. So the second time round wasn't actually a foul, by which time they were both in a heap. Yeah. And I don't think anyone was really seriously looking at the second contact or the second coming together, as being, well, whether it was a foul or not is not the point. It was that clearly the first one was a foul. You could argue that is the argument then, okay, the referee is playing advantage, really, because a split second later the contact in the area, it looks like March gets the ball anyway. So what we're actually saying here is that surely, yeah. And this is where we come to another issue. And last night, we're recording this on Thursday evening, the Football Association wished to actually take up with PG Moll about some kind of representation, about some discussion, some dialogue to explain what's going on with given decisions. Now, the broadcasters can only ever hear one side of it, and that's the referee. They cannot hear whoever the VAR referee is in Stockley Park. So at the end of the day, I think the Premier League, or certainly one of the football authorities, has come up with this, saying football fans can't be trusted to hear this. And you think, well, what are we going to do? Riot in our front rooms? With rugby, you get to hear the decisions being made, and then it's fair and open and honest. Now, when you've got a sport where a foul can be subjective and open to interpretation, that's one thing. But to have actually this explained, saying this foul was inside the box, and then you clearly see something different, what we're not getting is PG Moll, who at the moment who have spent 2 years trying to scramble their way to the top table and therefore not be beholden to anyone apart from themselves, now are just making these decisions without any comeback, without any explanation. And all of us fans are now just as bemused and frustrated and cheesed off with what on earth is going on.
Yeah, I'm absolutely. I mean, we said this. We talked about this last week, Al, about the fact that. I mean, okay, this one we've had our fair share of luck with some of the decisions with the VAR, but you know, I mean, the goal that Salah scored against us for Liverpool a couple of week or so ago. Yeah. You know, I mean, in the old days, that's onside. The offside rule was there to stop goal hanging, right? So
yeah. It's never was that, because if it was, then it wouldn't go back as far as the halfway line.
True. But I mean, is he getting a clear advantage? No, he's not. It's just basically to the letter of the law, yes, it's correct. But it's not there to be like micromanaged there in that way. And the advantage should be given to the attacker. And we're seeing this up and down in games all over the country, all over the world, where this is happening. And just get rid of it.
What you've also got is the quality of the management of the VAR system itself. And back in the...
Well, get players to do it then, because it's...
Well, no, not necessarily. I'm not... Well, if you're going to do that, then you could actually have... Well, you could have 12 people on a jury. But we're not going to have football by consent. We must have football by arbitration. Absolutely. But what you've not going to have is once upon a time back in the 70s, you could argue that, you know, England could produce some actually decent referees who actually understood the contention of the laws of the game. Now, admittedly, they've become a fudge on behalf of the broadcasters. What we've also got is that when you got PG Moll has actually then going its own and in cahoots with the Premier League, going its own way from IFAB. You've got various variations throughout various footballing countries as to what does or doesn't constitute a foul or an offside or a decision or this, that and the other. And when you go to Holland or Germany or France, they have far fewer issues with VAR, because the VAR referee will look at it, and if he can't say, well, I can't make my mind up after 10 seconds, 20 seconds, wherever it might be, go with the on-field thing. But we're not. It's the way the VAR is being misused is one thing, but then when you the Monday's game, I think, added to it and compounded to it, when you had something where you were judging a factual consideration, and the consideration was that the original contact was outside the box, and that's what you find frustrating.
It's massively frustrating, especially as well. I remember the Patrick Bamford one comes to mind against Crystal Palace earlier this season. Like, that was just... You know, I know it was against Crystal Palace, but still, come on, it was pretty bad. But full respect to how cool was Graham Potter after the match as well? I thought he must have been absolutely seething after that, and I thought the way he conducted himself in the pitch interviews afterwards, like instantly, you know, after the game. His adrenaline must have been flying, and he had the camera put the microphone put under him. And I thought he was very, very considered. I don't know many Premier League managers that could have been that diplomatic at that time. But
he is very diplomatic.
To have had a bit more passion.
If Graham Potter went off on a Jurgen Klopp style rant, I would be absolutely amazed.
Wait for it to happen then, mate. Wait for it to happen. He'll start talking about frozen snot and everything. So I think it's just one of those things you might need to clear up is that it's situations like this, where you're looking for was he in the area? Was he not in the area? Because I heard a lot of people say, why didn't he go to the screen? In situations like that, you don't go to the screen. It's VAR that takes over the decision.
Okay. Well, at the end of the day, it was an incorrect decision that cost us the game. We did have a couple of chances, but
we were good enough for a point. In the overall scheme of things, as much as people moan about this and are starting to get on Matty Ryan's back and grizzling about that and whatever it might be, we were good enough for a point. And when you then have it, that it's taken away from you by the officials, then, you know, there's not a huge amount you can do about it. But I think probably the answer would be, well, make sure you're 4-0 up by halftime and stop mucking about.
Yeah, there is that. But you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show is brought to you in association with fabulousoldfootballshirts.com, and we have got a shirt of the week for you. Darren, can you just have a look at this and describe this for me?
So we have a fluorescent orange short sleeves shirt with a blue and white stripe which runs down the front on the left-hand side slightly. And it says on the front of it, Zuka.nl.
Any ideas who that might be? Because what we've got here, I mean, it looks like it's something out of a pit crew. It says on the sleeve, well, it's clearly Dutch. One, because it's orange. Two, because it's .nl. But also on the sleeve, we've got Eredivisie. Skorum voor Gezondheid, it says. So I'm just wondering if that's some reference to sneezing. But I don't know if the Dutch for bless you is the same as the German for bless you. Phil's clearly mucked about with the badge on here. But
yeah,
Darren, would you like to hazard a guess as to who this might be?
Whew.
Clearly an Eredivisie side.
Okay. I'll go with a shot in the dark. Vitesse Arnhem.
That's a really good guess, because that's exactly who it is.
Is it?
And I'm and I am going to get so basically, we have regular listeners to this show will know we have a Dutch contribution from Werner and Lido, who both, as well as supporting the album, are big fans of Vitesse. And I am now about to butcher a load of Dutch. So. So I put Werner Lido, I apologise in advance, and anyone else in Holland, I'm really, really sorry.
No, you're not.
But here we go. This is your shirt of the week. These are the 2010 to 2011 away shirts of Dutch Eredivisie side Stichting Betaald Voetbal Vitesse, more commonly known as Vitesse Arnhem. The home ground is the Gelre Dome, which has a capacity of 21,248 for football matches. And for concerts, the capacity increases up to 41,000. The club has had a checkered past financially. In the mid-1980s, they fell into bankruptcy and spent a number of years struggling to get re-established. Such were the dramas on and off the pitch, they garnered the rather cruel nickname of FC Hollywood upon Rhine. Vitesse hold an annual memorial airborne match when they honour the World War II veterans from the Battle of Arnhem. For that one game a season, they changed kits to a dark red and blue in memory of the colours of the 1st Airborne Division of the British Army while the British Royal Legion parade at half-time. Money is raised for various charities in the same sort of style as their own Poppy Day appeal. Vitesse have had, they've got a number of organised fan groups, including two independent bodies. The 3,000 strong supporters of anything, Vitesse, who own the clubhouse, in the stadium, and the Arnhem Ultras, who have the very specific purpose to keep the atmosphere electric during games. And there are several other fan groups. Vivo, for example, are dedicated to choreography in the stands, and other groups represent charity and community action on behalf of the fans. Sadly, we're too cool in this country to allow such rampant coordination and displays of fanaticism. Thanks, Phil.
I can just see Werner doing his dance routine. Werner and Lido doing their dance routine on the terraces, actually.
I really can. All-time record appearances held by Theo Bossi, played 429 times for Vitesse between 83 and 98. And the main stand at the stadium is named the Theo Boss in his honour, as he passed away in 2013 at age just 47. His shirt, number 4, has also been retired permanently. Some other recognisable names who have played for the test, including Franz Tyson, Darren. who made a name for himself with Ipswich and Forest in England, and he finished his career in Arnhem. Wilfred Boney was a Dutch player of the year whilst with the test in 2013, and ex-Chelsea and now Villa striker Bertrand Traore spent time there in 2014-15. And Pierre van Huydonk was top scorer in his one season in 1990-2000. Albion links, Izzy Brown spent the season there in 2015. And of course, Davy Prepper played 142 times with Vitesse He was voted player of the season in his last season, 2014-15, before moving to PSV. Right, thanks for that, Phil.
And of I've been to Arnhem Stadium.
The Gelredome.
Yes. I don't know if you mentioned it, but about the fact that the pitch slides out on a tray under one of the stands.
Right.
For when they have to do, I don't know, horse of the year or tractor driving or whatever it was. But it was a fairly new stadium at the time for the Euro 2000. And I saw probably one of the worst games of football I'd ever seen. And I include Brighton at Gillingham within that consideration. It was Norway against Slovenia. It was tedium upon tedium. It was officiated by Graham Poll, who really didn't help at matters. And it was the third of a group game, the other one being, I want to say Yugoslavia, but I'm not sure if it wouldn't have been Yugoslavia in 2000. It would have been something tells me it was Yugoslavia against Spain, but whatever it was the game that finished 4-3 to Spain, and Spain got their winning goal. I think they've got their two goals in injury time to send Yugoslavia out. So when you've got that level of excitement at one game, then it's going to be balanced out the amount of tedium at the other game. And I sat and watched the tedious game. It was a dirge.
Okay. Well, Al, speaking of exciting games, one of the most exciting games of all time was in the 1982 World Cup, in the game between Italy and Brazil.
Do you remember this one? I mean, do you remember this game?
Yeah, I do remember it. Strange, I remember it really vividly. I mean, I was at school. I remember coming home from school and watching it. This was the time when Brazil were a lot more exotic than they are now. You didn't know any of their players, really. You might have known one or two of them, like Zico, for instance. But, you know, you had the likes of Socrates and Falcao.
This was probably the best Brazil side since 1970. You know, there weren't that much in 78. And in 74, they just got kicked out of the tournament by Holland. Or rather, they kicked themselves out. They were so brutal, were they? So this was a decent Brazilian side. And they were up against an Italy side, which, let's face it, had mossed their way through their group. They drew all three of their games. They only got through by virtue of scoring one more goal than Cambodia. But once they got to the knockout stages, when there was this group of death of Brazil, Argentina and Italy, they changed their ways and they really set fire to the competition. This was one of the games of the tournament. It's one of the games of all World Cup tournaments, which doesn't actually, to be fair, always offer up some great games. But this was one of them. And it's when we saw really the renaissance of Paolo Rossi. And this is what we're going to talk about. You know, the 82 World Cup was largely about him. He took his side the whole way. He ended up being the leading scorer, sadly passed away this week at the age of 64. But it's one of those things. It's the first. I remember watching bits and pieces of the 78 World Cup, but I certainly remember the one I was most in awe of was the 82 World Cup. That was the one I first started watching. You consider when West Germany got to the final, they were probably the most unpopular finalists ever. They'd lost to Algeria. They cheated their way against Austria. The goalkeeper decides to flatten one of the French players in the
semi-final. This was George Schumacher versus Patrick Battiston.
Schumacher on Battiston. You know, and the French side at that time was superb. They had an awesome midfield of Platini, Tigana and Rocheteau. They were amazing, and they really should have. France against Italy would have been the final. But Italy did it. They weren't as exciting as Brazil. And like I say, Brazil were a great side. But that game, that's the one I think that we'll all remember Paolo Rossi for. And if you're going to remember a great performance in a great game, then, yeah, you know you've made it in football.
Yeah. Well, one that he didn't fix.
Yes, there is that.
There is that. Okay, I mean, we've got to move on to a rather unsavoury incident, guys. Obviously, there was a situation that occurred at Millwall this week where the players took a knee before the game and the Millwall supporters roundly...
Not all of them.
Well...
They were heard.
The fact that it was more than one, it makes it a lot worse than it actually should. How do we feel about this? Because, I mean, there's been a lot of incidents this week as well. We had the incident with the PSG game getting abandoned this week as well.
Yeah.
I mean, where does this stop?
It's horrible, isn't it? It's you know, fans coming back to football, and you know, should have been such a great occasion of a celebration, and it just, for many, and you know, just sucked the life out of it, really. It was just unnecessary, and it just comes back to, you know, it's a problem in society which overspills into football, but football has a platform to deal with it, and hopefully, you know, the club will, you know, send out the right messages that you know, it's not going to be tolerated. And I think the majority, that, you know, the reaction has been, you know, one of outrage, and, you know, just it's unacceptable. And I think it is a minority. I think we have to remember that.
The whole point about it is what happened at Millwall is the very reason why players take the knee. You know, if you've had enough of fighting racism, go somewhere else. If you've had enough of thinking that this is being shoved down my throat, why can't I be racist? Why can't I be homophobic? Stay indoors. Don't come near us. You know, why should you become football's problem? You're going to be society's problem. We all have to muddle along together within society. But if you're going to do this in football, go away. Not interested. So I was delighted when, you know, QPR, you know, sort of shoved it back up them, really, when they took the knee for a goal celebration. I was immensely proud. I'm proud that we did it. I'm disgusted that we still have to do it. But I'm proud that when the players took the knee at the beginning of the Brighton-Southampton game, the crowd applauded, and applauded, you know, quite sort of vociferously. You know, they understand what's going on here. So if you've had enough of fighting racism, you've had enough of fighting prejudice, just stay at home, because we're not interested. And football, it's vital that something like football takes that lead. And if it means that we're going to take the knee for a long time, then so be it.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we it's a story that keeps repeating itself at the moment, but we'll leave it there, and hopefully we'll have a lot happier things to talk about next week after playing Fulham and Leicester. But that's all we've got time for this week. So thank you, of course, to Darren Howard. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Andy Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on the podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye.
She wears on her chest, and when daddy comes home, he never gets no rest, 'cause she's playing all night, and the music's alright. Mama's got a squeeze box, daddy never sleeps at night. Well, the kids don't eat, and the dog can't sleep, there's no escape from the music in the whole day.